VentureCast.
This guy gets amnesia, and then in the movie they make it so that he kidnaps, and it's a little more likable, like they fall in love for reasons. In the book, he kidnaps a Canadian economist who's also piping hot. That's the plot of that dumb book.
And yeah, well, I mean, that goes without saying, doesn't it? Like, Canadian economists.
Yeah. Seventh grade Ben Barton was like, wow, is that what it's like to sleep with a Canadian economist? I gotta find me one of those. Like, I don't know. Where do these women come from?
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
In Seattle, it's our pick, and Jeff Simons, you go first.
I can't remember. Did you say last week I was going first, or did you say I was? all right, so I've got the impossible job of trying to say something interesting and new about Jimi Hendrix, who some of you who listen to this podcast and are interested in music may have heard about. So I'm not going to do much on the biography. I will say I did, I read a Hendrix biography a couple of summers ago, and I had no idea what a rough childhood he had. Most of the stories I read about Hendrix when I was first discovering him picked up the story with his discharge from the army for being too weird to be in the army. Like, the story kind of picks up in 1961 and 62, where he's actually a Screaming Eagle paratrooper. He passes the paratrooper's test.
Wow.
And then he's just so bizarre that the army's like, you know what? Let's just, before you hurt yourself or somebody else, let's just call it even. And he starts kicking around bars in Seattle, and he gets a couple of session gigs, and he's with the Isley Brothers, and he's with Little Richard, and he's playing Greenwich Village as Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, and Chaz Chandler, the manager of the Animals, who's come over to New York on a talent scouting trip, sees him, brings him back to England, and turns him into the Jimi Hendrix that we know. He puts him with two pretty solid white British musicians, and they become this kind of multiracial England-American composite. And Hendrix explodes into fame because he's pulled out of the kind of R&B circuit that at that moment's at a low point, right? Like, the Isley Brothers and Little Richard, those are two big names, but not 1965, right? No. Like, they're playing dive bars, and they're like, their stars are descendant, you know? So Hendrix is rescued in a sense by the fact that there is a youth culture that's called rock music that's just about to just take over the world. He moves to England, gets signed, records the Hey Joe single 2 weeks before Sgt. Pepper comes out. He is in London when that record drops. And there's a famous story of him. He has a gig that the night the Sgt. Pepper comes out, he's playing at a club in London, and everybody, the word is out. So, like, everyone's gone to see him, including some of the Beatles. And he opens with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. He does it as his opening song. Yeah. And he's just he's in the right place in the right time in the zeitgeist. And he is also not haunted by a long discography with a lot of weird left turns and poor choices. Like, there's no Hendrix disco record, right? Because he dies tragically at the age of 27 as he's trying to complete what would have been his fourth studio record. Amazingly, they were running a tape recorder every time that guy ever appeared in a studio or played a show. There are hundreds of Hendrix bootlegs. There are hundreds of hours of outtakes and jams and alternate stuff. And the experienced Hendrix family legacy project has pretty much put every fart and clip and knock in. So it's hard to know where to start. I would say, like, if you're 17, you're like, where do I start with Jimi Hendrix? Like, you should absolutely start with the first record, Are You Experienced? But, like, when you start to try to deep dive, it's totally overwhelming. So I'm not going to talk about the first record and, you know, Fire and Hey Joe and all those. I want to just play some songs for you. Because here's the other thing about Hendrix. If it's 2024 and you're not sure, like, why do people talk about this guy in hushed tones? Because here's the thing. There are now guitar players who are faster. There are now guitar players who are a lot less sloppy. There are guitar players who are slightly better singers. There are guitar players who utilize effects in all these different ways. But Hendrix is where that starts. Hendrix, not the first virtuosic rock musician. He's among the very first, but Clapton's playing pretty fast before Hendrix. But he's the first electric guitar player who is using electricity and volume in ways to take his virtuosity to a space which it has never been before. He is the first guitar player to deliberately manipulate the sound of the electric guitar through feedback, through his own experimentation, through the emergent big watt Marshall amp company, through the emergence of pedals, effects pedals for the first time, the Unilever, the wah-wah. Like, he's the first guy to be dissatisfied with the sound of his guitar to the point where he's trying to wrestle a different sound. And you couple that experimentation with the speed and the dexterity and the moxie. Like, Hendrix is just so fearless. He performs as a trio through his entire career. So it's like bass, drums, and him. And he's just a sonic weapon. Like, he's just making so much noise by himself. And he's using, and he doesn't use volume in a way that's painful. Like, when I listen to Hendrix loudly and at volume, it's so warm and it's so enveloping. Like, it's pleasant. Like, he's not, it's not the assault on the senses that heavy metal will become, or even my favorite band, The Who, can be at times. Like, Hendrix is this, like, it's loud and delicious. So I'm going to just play four little things of Hendrix.
Okay.
And then Ben can complain that I picked all the wrong things. And he's not going to be wrong. Like, you can't do Jimi Hendrix in 4 1-minute clips. But this is the first time I first heard Jimi Hendrix when I was 12 years old. I bought a beat up copy of Are You Experienced? And I put it on and I loved it instantly. And I liked all the singles which I'd heard. And I love Mitch Mitchell's drumming. Like, Manic Depression is just one of my favorite songs ever. But I was really drawn to the weird stuff. I was drawn to, like, the title track and Third Stone from the Sun, which is a big, long jam. But the first time I remember listening carefully to a Hendrix guitar performance and just thinking, like, okay, I can't do that. And I really want to be able, I want to learn how to do that, is the first 90 seconds of his performance at the Monterey Pop Festival. So this is Hendrix comes back to America. He's gone to England. He's gotten signed. He's made a record. He's coming back to America to play the Monterey Pop Festival with The Who and all these other famous, right? He's at the festival of 1967. This is the first 90 seconds of that performance. This is the performance where he famously sets a red Stratocaster on fire at the end. He's pouring lighter fluid on it. It's coming out. The end, that's the part they always show you, is when he destroys his guitar. But he destroys the audience before the show even starts with I think, this amazing first 90 seconds of playing. There's no other guitar player playing in rock and roll at that moment who can play like that. Like, who can play at that volume with and sustain the sound and the volume without it, like, taking control of the sound. But he's not all flash. Like, one of the beautiful things about Hendrix is how restrained his playing can be. One of my favorite Hendrix performances is a slow blues called Red House. And my favorite Red House is from 1969, it's on a record called Hendrix in the West, and he's playing San Diego Sports Arena, which is not a place where you'd expect, like, to hear just anguished, heartbreaking guitar. But this first, like, 70 seconds of Red House is some of my favorite Hendrix playing. Thank you. So, like the first song, Killing Floor, is an old blues that he turns into a rock song, but Red House is an old blues and he sticks with the blues, right? Like Hendrix's great secret weapon is that he's an African American artist working in this new white world of rock music without the enroll or without the R&B. And he fuses those two worlds together. He takes like really traditional black blues guitar playing and then takes all this new equipment that's emerging for mostly white rock acts and he puts them together. He's not a purist like Clapton, who's another white artist working in a black vernacular. Is he's interested in doing different forms with it. And it starts to create kind of a new kind of super heavy music, which you hear at the very end of his career. And a month before he dies, he plays Fillmore East on New Year's Eve and records a song called Machine Gun. And you can just hear on this, like he's through the looking glasses. He's playing in a way that just other people haven't caught up to yet. He gets up to that high B. That has more in common with Ornette Coleman than it does with 12-bar blues rock. And yet, for all of that, like Hendrix doesn't survive because he was this incredibly virtuosic guitar player. Like virtuosity for its own sake only take you so far. He's a hell of a writer. He's a great, great writer. Like, he writes great songs and he lets them be songs and they're not even defined by their guitar solos in a lot of the recordings. They're just, and you know, and I think you can make an argument that in the 10 greatest guitar riffs of all time, he's got a couple of potential entries. So I'll close with my favorite, if you put a gun to my head, my favorite Hendrix riff, the one that I always want to keep hearing, and it won't be a surprise to anybody, I assume. There's that wah-wah pedal being really used to purpose. Close by saying Woo. That people want to remember Hendrix as this kind of like either like proof that the 1960s were this great moment of racial harmony. We have a black guitar player with a white band crossing the seas and crossing American and British spaces, and that's bullshit. Like Hendrix faced so much racism and so much discrimination, and he was just emerging. He's just emerging into this like black consciousness that has him writing songs about why are all these 19-year-old black kids in Vietnam and nobody else, and wanting to work with Miles Davis and starting to bring a sensibility to his lyrics. Like he starts as like this kind of like flower power, acid trip, like kid. But by the time we get to 1970, like he has started to bristle against being white rock and roll's token black guitar hero. And one of the things I'm glad he didn't live to see how much society let him down in some ways, but I rue what we lost. Like, he was about to enter into a moment that Sly and the Family Stone and Funkadelic and War and like all these funk bands are about to emerge, and James Brown's great second band that's about to kick the doors in 1971. The fact that we don't have Hendrix's version of that moment of Americanness, like what would the Jimi Hendrix Stevie Wonder song recorded in 1974 sound like? Like, that
Wow.
lost music
Yeah.
haunts me. And I think I don't want to be one of these rock historians that doesn't pay tribute to the fact that he did all of that while dealing with the just inherent lazy racism of the scene that made a hero out of him at the same place.
Yeah.
That's it. That's my
Woo!
Hendrix. So.
Good stuff. He walks away.
Yes. Love that one, Jeff. Hey,
Good stuff.
you asked the where to start. What do you think the five most played songs of
God, I
Hendrix
have no
on Spotify
idea.
are? I'll give you a hint. Good. They're good.
Okay. That's
Just see
good.
if you can name them.
Well,
Hey,
is
Joe.
Voodoo Child one of them? I want Voodoo Child
Voodoo
to be one
Child
of
is
them.
number five.
All
Okay.
right. Okay.
Hey,
Is
Joe's number
Fire?
four.
Okay.
Is Fire one of them?
No.
Okay.
There's only one other one from the first album, then there's one from the second album, and another one from the third album.
Is Castles Made of Sand the one from the second record?
Not Little Wing.
Oh, of
Oh,
course.
sure.
But
Yeah.
isn't that a
Great
great
one.
call? That, I mean, like,
Yes.
good taste, people of
Yeah.
America, or people of the
Yep.
world, I guess. You're
Yep.
missing two.
What do you got?
Well, one's a cover.
Oh, Watchtower.
Oh, yeah. Watchtower is number
Okay.
one. And by the way, great call. Like, if
Yeah.
you were
Yeah.
like, hey, I've got 4 minutes to learn everything I need to know about, like, basically rock music, you could choose it as well. But
Yeah,
for
not
Hendrix,
bad.
that's a
Yeah,
great first song.
you're right. That's
And then
excellent.
Purple Haze.
Oh,
Oh,
yeah.
perfect.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's a five, like, in comparison to Aretha's top five, like, those
I
are.
know. Yeah, no Freeway of Love in a big Cadillac haunting
Yeah,
Jimi
no, man. And
Hendrix.
it also, like, you get Hey Joe, which is a slower blues one. You get Purple Haze, which is like a more traditional rock song with a big
Yep.
chorus. It could have been a Doors song if it was the Doors were
Yeah,
on there.
right.
And then you get the 2 minute Little Wing, just fantastic.
Yeah. Awesome.
I was really, really, really struck and taken with the first two.
Yep.
And I had a buddy in high school whose favorite act was Stevie Ray Vaughan. And he was like, Stevie Ray Vaughan's the greatest, and I love him. And he's the world's greatest guitarist, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, Stevie Ray Vaughan is a fine guitarist. And I quite like Stevie Ray Vaughan, but it's unacceptable to have him be your favorite act. And he
Yeah.
was like, why? And I was like, because he's just a ripoff of other people who are better than him. And the first 30 seconds of the first song you played, like, that's six different Stevie Ray Vaughan songs.
Right.
And then
Starting
that version of
out.
Fred House is the other half of Stevie Ray Vaughan's catalog. Like,
Yep.
he captured everything that he did completely riding on the back of Hendrix.
I mean, like, I think most people of our generation heard Voodoo Child's, they might have heard Stevie Ray's version first from Couldn't Stand the Weather, because he does like an 8 minute note for note cover of it
Yeah,
from
for
Couldn't Stand
sure.
the Weather.
I hope that's not true, but that does seem likely to be true. The other thing I'll note is that people sleep on him as a singer. I mean, he's got a beautiful,
He sure
beautiful,
does.
super characteristic powerhouse of
And
a voice.
it was getting better too. Like the last record, which he doesn't really finish, which is going to be called First Rays of the New Rising Sun, has some unbelievable vocal performances on it. Room Full of Mirrors and Isabella, Freedom. I mean, there's some singing on that record.
Yep.
All
Amazing.
right. Great work, Jeff Simons. Ben, what you got?
Yes. So everyone's going to know what I'm going to pick. Very, very, very happy to wind up in Seattle and very enthusiastically happy to talk about Pearl Jam. So we've actually covered Pearl Jam several different times. So first, I want to give a little shout out to Favorite Things. Because there was like a 10-year period where Pearl Jam was my favorite band. And dude, I am in the middle of what I'm calling the great reread. And I'm going back through my life, and any book that I remember being my favorite book for a period of my life, I'm rereading.
Oh my God.
That's great.
So it actually happened at the podcast at one point. We were talking about books, and I was like, I think that Gilead by Marilynne Robinson might be my favorite book. And you guys were like, wow. So, dude, like a week later, I just got it off the shelf and reread it, and I was like, holy shit. That book is so unbelievably amazing. Anyhow, then I was like, I don't know why I don't reread more books. Like, I mean, I read new books too, but I don't know why I don't just pick up books that I know that I loved. So I went back and did Watership Down. That was worth it. I did Gilead first, but then I went back because Watership Down was my favorite book, fifth, sixth grade for sure. Like, I just absolutely love that one. Such a masterwork. And then I reread it to the girls. And then, dude, I reread it now just to myself as a 54-year-old man. Couldn't have enjoyed it more. Like, just a banger all the way through. And, like, all this, like, buried life wisdom. And again, one of the things that's great about the reread is, like, as an adult, you get to re-experience it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I can see why little Ben Barton loved this, but bigger, older Ben Barton also loves it.
Right.
Let's see if either one, you know, you're going to be able to guess. What do you think my favorite book was in seventh grade? This is the one I just finished.
Was it the one where the dogs die?
No, it's The Bourne Identity.
Was it really?
Great. So great. So great.
Robert Ludlum?
In That's seventh awesome. Grade, I got into a huge, I read all the Dashiell Hammett books.
Oh,
I read
my God.
All the Robert Ludlum books, and I read a bunch of other spy books. I read like Le Carre and Smiley's People and all of that crap. But the Ludlum books were the best, and the first Bourne Identity, which, by the way, rereading it, first of all, I loved it. It was great. Uh-huh. I highly recommend rereading it. Second, it's so unbelievably hilarious. The plot of this book is so stupid. This guy gets amnesia, and then in the movie they make it so that he kidnaps, and it's a little more likable, like they fall in love for reasons. In the book, he kidnaps a Canadian economist who's also piping hot. That's the plot of that dumb book.
Anyway, well, I mean, that goes without saying, doesn't it? Like, Canadian economists.
Yeah, seventh grade Ben Barton was like, wow, is that what it's like to sleep with a Canadian economist? I gotta find me one of those. Like, I don't know. Where do these women come from?
Oh, man.
They come from the imagination of Robert Ludlum.
Totally. Anyhow, taking a page from that, I just started this week off with This Is Pearl Jam. And I've just been listening to Pearl Jam all the way through. And unlike my more traditional way of doing this, where I would just skip ahead to the songs I don't know. The songs I know, I'm like, oh yeah, know that one. I just went ahead and let it roll. And listened through it's actually a pretty short mix if I don't listen to the ones I know. I mean, I know 50, 60 Pearl Jam songs backwards and forwards.
Yeah,
and
from the second they start.
I know all of the notes. I know all of the lyrics. I know where they fit in the discography. I know what they were talking about. I know what the band was going through at that time in their life and what I was going through at that time in their life. And there's this thing about having something be your favorite that's so powerful. And for music especially, and this, I said this before, but I'll say it again. Like, the great thing about Pearl Jam was, like, my previous favorite band, the band they replaced was the Rolling Stones, who are in fact great. Uh-huh. But in high school and in college, I was not under the impression or the misimpression that I was living through the heyday of that band. Like, they were still putting out good records. I like Dirty Work. Like, I'll ride for that. That's fine. And I mean, Tattoo You is actually a really pretty good record, but it doesn't touch. I did not live through their heyday.
Right.
Pearl Jam, I lived through their heyday. Like, I lived through the best of their material, saw it from the beginning all the way to the end. And just absolutely loved it. What I covered last time with the tour, like, what a pain in the ass they were, and they were fighting with everybody. I forgot to mention that had a flip side to it. So along with, like, fighting with Ticketmaster and refusing to tour regularly, they also decided to become like the Grateful Dead and create like their own special group of people that was basically a fan group where you would join the 10 Club and then they would send you a record every year. And then they would put you at the top of the list for the tickets for any show. You got they sent out the tour list before any of the tickets came on sale, and you got to buy it through the 10 Club. And so, I mean, I sat, you know, fifth row, several different shows as I was a member of the 10 Club. And
As did I. In fact,
now
we
as
sat
an
in some of those
adult,
seats together. Yeah.
now as an adult, I'm like, what a pain in the ass that must have been for that band. You know what I mean? Like, someone had to set that up. They had to pay, like, the label didn't pay for that. Like, they had to, like, take their own money and pay for these employees to create this thing that was only for the super fans. What a generous act by them.
Yep.
Just unbelievable. And there's a lot of, if you read the popular press and the tale of Pearl Jam, it's like they drove away their fans. You know, their first album was so big, and then Versus was also big, but it was harder to deal with than the first one, so it was less big. And then Vitalogy, and basically every record is a downward staircase where they're selling fewer albums. And it is true, the work becomes more challenging. But there's another part to that. They skipped the other half of this, which is they really hugged the super fans. They were like, we want the people who are just here because of Alive and Jeremy to get off the bus. But the people who are here because they love us, like we're all riding together. And it was like a really beautiful fan band experience. Like,
in fact, do you remember when USA Today did a what is the most popular band of the last 40 years poll? And nobody knew what to do because Pearl Jam won, and it wasn't even close because every Pearl Jam fan saw it, got on board, like made sure they voted for them. And when they interviewed people, like, why the hell they haven't had a hit record in 12 years? And like, you're not paying attention, man. The shows are unreal, and they're making record, they're making music for us. And they, you know, there are 20,000 people in every major city who can't wait to be in community together listening to that band. I was so heartened by it. Like, boy, did they pull off a magic trick.
Right. And then they play these 2.5 hour, three. I mean, it's very Springsteen-y. Like, they play 2.5, 3 hour shows. They're different every night. It's a huge mix of things. But it's Springsteen-y in the good ways, too, where it's like the show's different every night. The set's different every night. They always play 5 awesome songs you know. Always, always. There's no version of it where you go away and you're like, wow, I can't believe they let us down or whatever. They didn't play at least one of the songs that I love. And there's that just special synergy when your favorite band also likes the super fans and they're like all vibing together and stuff. And you know, they're the band I've seen the most of any other bands. And that's worked out great for me. I have not seen a bad show. They are fantastic. I've seen them most recently 2 times headlining Bonnaroo, and they shred it. They just shred it. They can still really, 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 really play. The records, like, are not as good. That's just a fact. And the songs are not as good. They're still interesting. Like, they still keep pumping it out.
What is the last Pearl Jam record that you listen to where you're like, this is actually empirically a good record, and if it was a new band, I'd be excited about it?
That's a really hard one. Which is later, Riot Act or Binaural?
Riot Act is...
Yeah, Riot Act is the later one then.
That's a long time ago. I have a real soft spot for Backspacer.
Oh,
which
nice.
Is
I like that.
35 minutes long and 11 songs and goes down, like, is just like over before you know it, and 8 of the 11 songs are super hummable. Like,
that's great. That's
and
a good one.
I rediscovered it doing a thing that you're describing where I was like, I should go back and like give these records a chance, because I find myself bogged down in a lot of them. Like, I wish it was 3 songs shorter, and this song's really not that good. But Backspacer really surprised me.
That's awesome.
Super fans want the Avocado record to be the one that everybody thought that was the big comeback record, and I just get bored 2/3 of the way through. But Backspacer, I recommend.
They have a new album out right now, right?
They have a single album's coming out. Yeah,
album's
totally.
Coming out. Okay.
Single was pretty good.
I like the single. Yeah.
And they are a legit Seattle band. Like, those dudes actually live in Seattle. They still live in Seattle. They never moved. I had the great good fortune to see them finish. I can't remember what, maybe it was 97, 98. They finished their tour in Seattle.
Oh, cool.
I got the tickets to the 10 Club, so I was right up close. It was either my birthday or the day after my birthday, and it's always listed as one of 10 best Pearl Jam shows. Unbelievably good. So good. Anyhow, I personally love them. Your mileage will vary, regardless of that, I would suggest loving things. It's just so fun. So fun to have favorite things. And I really went back and forth about what song to play. I had a really, really challenging time because there's so much beautiful music. I almost chose Release because that was what they used to open their shows with. And that song is really
and when
powerful.
He kicked in, when he went, oh, you felt dude, it in your chest. It was like the next 3 hours, I am all in. Like, it's just unbelievable.
So fantastic. But I decided to just go with my favorite live version of my favorite Pearl Jam song. I'm going to ask Jeff to pull up Corduroy from Live on Two Legs and go to 145 so we can get the full chorus and then we can get the bridge. And it's the bridge that just murders me.
Excellent.
In this.
Yep.
So
this
great.
Is a song Vitalogy that's about their struggle with fame and their like they're just the battle to try and come to peace with it. And so the this bridge, everything has chains. And that's like that's a rule of physics. That's a it's a life statement that is absolutely true. Some of the chains are good, some of the things are bad, but everything has chains. Comma. Absolutely nothing's changed. Like, he's the same guy. And then take my hand, not my picture. Like, that's a plea. That's a plea to his fans.
Yeah.
He's like, just come with me on this journey. And I'm not a famous person like you. And then I looked up the lyrics and I had the lyrics wrong like the entire time I've known Pearl Jam. Jeff, do you know what the next lyrics are?
Spill my tincture. I believe
Correct.
Is what comes next.
I assumed I that's a terrible lyric. I don't know why I asked that there. I have still my teacher.
Yes, of course, that. Still my teacher. This is one
that
of those songs.
Such good lyrics. Like to
also, I think everything has changed. Absolutely nothing's changed, which is what I thought it was the first time.
Right.
It's also a great lyric.
Yeah.
It's just one of those onomatopoetic, like it's even better when you learn it's chains, but it was great when it wasn't. But yeah, still my teacher. Of course, it's still my teacher.
Yeah, just so fantastic. And to see these dudes struggle through fame, struggle through all the fights, stay together and still just be like happy. And Jeff will remember this. I mean, I've seen them. I've seen them 5 or 6 different times where Vedder came out with a bottle of red wine and drank the entire thing in a set.
Yeah, and we were like, uh-oh.
And I was like, I come from a family. I mean, not everybody in my family, but there are people in my family who are professional drinkers. I know what it looks like. That's not good. That's not good. When when you arrive at your job and you're like, I'm going to get through my job by drinking an entire bottle of wine while I do it. It's not happiness. And so to see him all happy and healthy in his 50s, you know, still getting after
great.
It, such as it is.
Yeah. So awesome. Two things to just add, like I saw Pearl Jam on Halloween night, 1993, right before Versus came out. Like they recorded it in San Francisco and they did a little micro tour of the Bay Area. They played San Jose and then San Francisco and then they played the Greek Theater on Halloween 1993. It's still the best show I've ever seen. If I really think about like, what is a rock concert? I was like, I am in the right place at the right time seeing one of the best bands in the world right before it explodes. That was it. I was just like, it's up there with like Radiohead at Bonnaroo. I mean, it was just magical. The second thing I will say is Ben is so right that you have to have favorite things. And fellas, this right here is one of my favorite things.
Oh, what a transition.
Right here,
let's
I love
go.
It.
This
That's
right
terrific.
Here.
This right
is
here
one
is
of
one of
favorite
my
things.
Favorite things as well. Good stuff. All right. Well, let's bring Seattle to a close. Jeff, are you up for playing these clips, or should I just
Oh,
name
heck
the
yeah.
songs? You
Oh,
are?
dude, I am
All right,
on
so
it. I
Ben
think Ben should
Barton.
have to name them, right? He's gonna
Ben,
know.
you're going to try to name each
Oh no,
song.
you're gonna humiliate me?
And at the end,
My listening hat has been taken away.
you have to tell us what the songs have in common. Hit it.
All right, ready? Here's number one.
Okay.
Oh, wait, am I supposed to guess?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought
Oh,
you were
all
going
right.
right
That's
to.
I don't know who the act is, but that's from the Mike Myers parody. What's that? It's
Yeah, Austin
Austin
Powers.
Austin
Yes,
Powers.
it
Okay,
is
good.
Soul
Soul
Bossa
Bossa Nova.
Nova. Yes. All right.
Okay,
Next
good. I got
song.
that
Next
one.
step.
Nice job.
But I'm
No, you
Cheryl,
got the wrong.
and I can always.
You told me the one featuring Gone, so that's the one I gave
No,
you.
Leslie Gore.
Oh, Leslie Gore. Okay. You Don't Own Me by Leslie Gore was supposed to be next, so.
All right, next
That
one.
sounds
Okay,
like
coming up
Macklemore.
next.
Was it Macklemore coming
Yeah.
in there?
With G-Eazy.
Oh, come on now. Separate and Son. That's too easy for me.
This is the greatest thing
Right.
ever. By the
Next
way,
one.
people at
Oh.
home, if you don't take the whole 2 minutes and 31 seconds to hear the whole Sanford and Son theme, you're missing out. It's so great. Number four.
That's I'll Be Good to Ya by the Brothers Johnson, that later remade by Ray Charles and Chaka Khan. It's the
Oh,
song where
I don't
Ray.
know. That's a band I know for remaking Strawberry, they had that one hit, Strawberry 23, whatever that song is called.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
All right,
My
lastly.
brain's not working. This song takes forever to get going.
That first song definitely sounded Michael Jackson to me.
It is.
That's
We all know
smooth,
that
dude.
one.
I love that one.
All
So
right.
what's the through line?
I have to wander through Timmy's brain. I have no idea.
The through
Tell him, Timmy.
line is my choice to represent Seattle. It is Quincy Jones Jr.,
Oh,
producer
Benny Lyki. That's a great call.
extraordinaire. He wrote some of those songs, but he produced all of them. And the more. This is one of the greatest Wikipedia pages I've ever come across.
He's the best,
The
man,
guy
Quincy.
is born in 1933, still alive, March 14th. He just had his birthday. So he's 91 years old. And the fact that I just watched the We Are the World documentary this past weekend plays a big part in why I chose him, because that was such an extraordinary event. Trying to handle all those singers, getting them to
And
sing,
so
trying to get Stevie Wonder to drop the Swahili and just kind of go with the song that's been written.
Oh, man, it's
That
amazing.
was amazing. But check out some of his stuff. A film producer and TV producer. He's produced The Color Purple, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the
Wow.
subsequent series Bel-Air, Mad TV, the movie Their Eyes Were Watching God. I don't know if you ever watched that miniseries in the 90s called The History of Rock and Roll, but he was the producer for that. I don't know if you saw Shaq's turn as a superhero in Steel, but Quincy Jones.
Is he the producer of that?
Yeah, that might have been a mess. That might have been a mess.
So listen, I hope he got paid up front.
That's right. He produced The Wiz, and he pulls the greatest Dick Cheney move ever as they're working on the music from The Wiz. Michael Jackson asks him, "Hey, I'm going to try to launch a solo career. Do you know of any good producers who are really good at this moment?" And Quincy Jones is like,
"I know one.
Let me look into that for you." And then he comes back, "It's me, baby." And so he produces Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad. It's pretty much right. That makes him one of the greatest producers of all
Correct.
Time. Just
if you haven't seen Rashida Jones's documentary about her dad,
oh, I haven't.
I highly recommend it. It's great. What it's so great. He is such a hilarious character of a human being.
Yes.
And I mean, like, it's an amazing life story, and the philandering and the Rashida's many, 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 many brothers and sisters whom he loves unconditionally and makes have Sunday dinner with him. I mean, it's just like, it's like a We Are the World reunion of all his children. It's so
it's
great.
Five marriages, but he has children from seven different women. In 1974, so he goes in high school, he's in Seattle, and he goes to see Ray Charles, and he introduces himself to Ray Charles. And so begins this great, great friendship between the two men. He gets a scholarship to UW, then a scholarship to Berkeley. Then he starts playing for Sarah Vaughan and arranging for Sarah Vaughan. He does a European tour with Lionel Hampton, comes back, plays for Elvis, and then he goes on a tour with Dizzy Gillespie. He's 22 years old at this time.
Yeah.
He's living in France. He says, "I'm playing with the greatest jazz band in the world, and we're all starving." And that's when I learned the difference between music and the music business. And so he kind of starts thinking about how he can make money at the same time. His family had a quote. I want to share the quote with you. This is what his dad impressed upon him. "Once a task is just begun, never leave until it's done. Be the labor great or small, do it well or not at all."
How much of your advice to your children rhymes?
Oh my gosh, I'm stealing that. I hope it's not too late with my children.
I think my daughter might just turn and bazooka vomit at me if I tried to if I tried an aphorism that rhymed.
A rhyming
clean your room and do it well, or for sure you'll go to hell. I just can't imagine what would happen.
She might like that one. Produced 50 albums for other artists, produced 40 albums for himself, produced 25 movie albums. First African-American conductor to be nominated for an Academy Award. He has the most Academy Award nominations by any Black person, which is probably a bad sign because he's only getting those for music. An amazing, amazing life that is still going on. He worked with Frank Sinatra. "We needed to know who produced L.A. Is My Lady, and now we know. It was Quincy Jones."
You cannot imagine how great the footage is of Frank and Quincy in Rashida's documentary, because Frank is just all cheese, and he's like, "My man, Q." I mean, it's just like, "Quincy, get up here. Get up here, friend." Like, it's just amazing.
So great. He has a ring from Frank Sinatra. So if he ever needs to get into Sicily, he's just going to flash that ring. Also, Ben, you'll be happy to know, like, I know you've been wondering who produced Yamo Be There with Michael McDonald. It was Quincy Jones. Yeah, he was there.
Yamo blew my brains out.
The best tidbit from the Wikipedia research I did today was that sadly he got a brain aneurysm in 1974. They thought it would be terminal, and so he wanted to have a memorial service in 1974. He's lived a really good life. He's 41 years old and he's gonna die. So he arranges it. It's got Sidney Poitier, Richard Pryor, Marvin Gaye, and Quincy Jones, also in attendance for his own memorial service, where he has people speak about him and perform with his doctor by his side in case he's going to collapse. But he survived all the way to this day.
That is a nice move right there.
That's amazing.
So let's have Quincy Jones and Ray Charles take us out. This is In the Heat of the Night from the Sidney Poitier movie. This is 1967.
In the heat of the night, seems like a cold sweat creeping across my brow. Yeah, in the heat of I'm feeling motherless somehow. Stars with evil eyes stare from the skies on mean and bright.
Yeah, lovely, lovely stuff. He produced that album, did the soundtrack for that movie as well. The guy was just on fire for so long, really helping define American culture. And sadly,
you know,
in the
my
80s
wife
and 90s,
totally...
he defined it with electronic drums, because some of those songs from the late 80s. Woo!
My wife thinks I work too hard, and it was great to watch the Quincy Jones documentary with her, because I was like, dude, I'm a lazy ass compared to this guy. Like, the next time you tell me, like, Jeff, you work so hard, you really got to slow down, I'm just going to make you watch the Quincy Jones documentary so you can remember what a schmuck I am.
Because he would have like 25 projects going at the same time. Like, just a
amazing
full calendar of events.
And I mean, like, so Michael Jackson deserves primary credit for his work, obviously. He's the primary artist there. That being said, think about Quincy Jones in his mid-40s into his mid-50s doing those three records. And what those records sound like. I mean, first of all, like, if you haven't listened to Off the Wall in a minute, it's fucking fantastic. It's so good. And it's not just that the songs are great, like that, or like, it's just the arranging. Like, the arranging is unbelievably good. The guitar work in those three records, each one is just like better than the last. So likable and really, really, really unique and unusual. Like, Off the Wall is a really super badass, amazingly good sounding disco record. And the reason why is because it sounds like a soul record too. Like, he jams in like all of his lifetime of knowledge into that work. And the instrumentation of it is so fantastic. It's awesome. And then to the leap from there to Thriller, like,
big leap.
Jackson challenged him, and they rose to the challenge. I mean, like, the sound of Thriller, I mean, he creates the sound of an entire decade from there.
Right.
And then this is like, I mean, this Jeff hates this argument. I like the Use Your Illusion 1 and 2. I'm like, even better than Appetite. Like, they came back even better. And I know it's really dumb, but I fucking love Bad. I love it. That record sounds so, oh my God. Yes, it's great.
Dirty Diana.
Oh, thank you, Timmy. Dirty Diana is a forgotten gem. Little Steve Vai for you.
Yeah.
Dirty Diana is actually my go-to. That's the one that I always point out if people haven't listened long enough.
That's fantastic.
All three of those records sound just like lights out. Unbelievable. And dude, Smooth Criminal is a great selection from that. Bad, the song, just sounds like a gajillion dollars. Like, it's so great sounding. Love it.
You know, when I dropped B off for a play date yesterday and she had the 80s radio station on, it was playing Bad. And 9 hours later, when I picked her up, Bad was on again.
Okay. It came right around.
It was like, fair enough.
It was like, yeah, that seems about right.
Oh, good stuff. All right,
fellas. All right.
Well, no shower. No hot water in the plane household. I'm going to the gym.
Okay.
Get showering.
And next time I see you, it's a best of episode, right? We're
going to bang out
rethinking.
2023. What was the best song of 2023? Now that it is in the books, we have to have our say. We're going to go back to season 1 with our next podcast. And then following that, we'll go back to season 2 and pick the best album of 2023. Which
All
means,
right.
which means I got to do some research because I don't really listen to current songs.
Yeah, why change a winning formula now, my brother?
Good stuff. All right, gentlemen. Have a great night.
Love you, fellas. Well done.
Yeah, you too, buddy. Bye.
Welcome to Sarah Talk Solutions. Ladies and gentlemen, you've tuned into a bit of a different type of show. I'm Sarah B and I'm your host. You can find me on my IG, which is Aussie_Sarah_LA. I talk about amazing, relevant conversations and topics and what functions that goes on in this magical, wonderful, wonderful city of the City of Angels. My IG, which is Aussie_Sarah_LA.
Hey there, fabulous souls. I'm Stephanie Baklaan.
And I'm Eden Alpert.
And we're the hosts of the brand new podcast, Unapologetically Fab.
Get ready to join us on an amazing and real journey as we dive into life after 40 and own it.
We're all about changing the narrative, leaning into who you are, and living a life by your own design.
Join us as we embrace life unapologetically and redefine success.
This is Unapologetically Fab,
an Electric Cast production.
See you there.
Electric Cast.